Okay, this panel discussion except three speakers today. We invited two more specialists in this field. One is Mr. Michael Lang and Peter Prakash. Am I right? The pronunciation? Prakash is right. Mr. Lang is quite a local person. He's the person he's the director of Smithsonian Marine Program, as well as he's the director of Smithsonian Diving Program. Am I right? He is a specialist in diving, ice diving in Antarctica from 1987, as far as I remember, right? And Peter is now the managing director of the UNEP in Norway, based in Norway. His background is a marine biology, especially he worked quite a long time on Arctic birds. So he's quite the perfect person to be a panelist. So before we start, I'd like a quick question to Dr. Miller. You speak a lot about the Kammler, how Kammler works and what the main focus of Kammler. But you think Kammler is or will be the enough tool to managing bio resources in the Southern Ocean in the future?
You mean in terms of bioprospecting?
Yes.
Yeah. $64,000 question. Let's get going. One has to say that the mechanisms that are present within Kammler in terms of the decisions and in terms of the ability to collect information are certainly there and probably capable of assuming that responsibility. But I think that that's only sort of half the answer. I think the actual answer goes a little bit more towards how this particular endeavour will unfold itself. And there's a whole lot of debates, and I don't think there's a very clear vision as yet whether this is going to be an endeavour that's self-regulatory, whether or not it's going to be of sufficient magnitude, given that Kammler has priorities of its own, that it would require Kammler becoming involved in a formative sense and in a managerial sense. So I think we certainly, if it's within the marine realm, I mean, for example, there are something like 340, I think it is, at the last count, patents that are developed for essentially biopharmaceuticals from Antarctic krill. Now, you know, those are using quantities of a fishery currently running at about 140,000 tons a year. They're using quantities probably less than 5,000 tons. Is that significant? Would that vex Kammler in terms of a management? That's not a question that Kammler's asked itself, and I think it's unclear to where it's going to go. Equally, on the other hand, if, for example, it would be something to deal with some dependent species such as a minor copepod, would Kammler be the place for that, where possibly some of the structures under SCAR might be more appropriate because there's more science that's required at levels that Kammler's not focused at times and space scales. So I think it's a difficult question, and I haven't answered the question, but hopefully I've thrown out some ideas that maybe some people in the audiences who are brighter than I am might be able to pick up and Olaf's feeling sorry for me. He's very nice to me. Can develop.
I apologize. I should give some opportunity to make a comment for the new specialist we invited. I'm sorry for that. So if you make anything to suggest or comment first. Yeah, Peter.
Okay, thank you very much. As a biologist here, I observed during the discussions and presentations that at the beginning of these 2 days, we had a major focus on geoscience, atmospheric science, and that is probably also a certain focus in the Antarctic research. Today, the particularly about the information about Kamala and marine environment, I think that leads also to the question whether in the future, or as we have next year, the International Year of Biodiversity, whether the research and the scientific work in the Antarctic can also make a specific contribution to biodiversity in the way as it was indicated in some cases. For example, the Convention on Biological Diversity had the aim that by the year 2010 we would have a representative network of protected areas, both terrestrial and marine. On the terrestrial ground, that has in numbers has almost been reached, but not at all in the marine field, where less than 1% is protected, and of that one protected, it has hardly any representation. It's mainly coastal areas, tiny bits. And of those bits, most of them, or hardly 0.1%, are representative areas which are unused. So following what Denzil Miller said about representativeness and what Olaf Urheim said about the discussion about representative marine protected areas, and also in the context that there is a certain gap of understanding of the science world about the Antarctic and what the NGOs or the global society thinks about the world park and pristine nature, I think there should be a link between both and marine protected areas in a way that on the one side they are scientifically based and representative, for instance, but on the other side, give enough space for totally no catch areas, for totally untouched areas, which gives at least both for the science world as well as for those which see the picture of an undisturbed world, give a place in Antarctica. And I think that is the role of within the Antarctic Treaty and in the spirit of it, that this should be also taking place. So I would make a prayer that we are thinking about using the Year of Biodiversity, in particular focus on the marine wealth of the Antarctic, and also with a view of representativeness in terms of marine protected areas.
Okay, Michael.
Thank you. I'm Michael Lang. I'm with the Office of the Undersecretary for Science here at the Smithsonian, and I want to first off congratulate Paul and the International Board for all the work they've done to be able to bring this event together here, which has been fantastic these first 2 days, and we have another day and a half to go. I would like to represent the scientists, the human factor in the Antarctic. You've all seen March of the Penguins. And everybody's always worried about those poor little penguins and how they survive in that extreme environment. Well, guess what? There's somebody behind the camera filming those poor little penguins at minus 70. The wind's blowing horizontal. Most of our marine biological work, we manage the National Science Foundation's U.S. Antarctic Diving Program. So we provide the training and the supervision of the scientists who work in the Antarctic, mainly at McMurdo and at Palmer Station. We have approximately, since 1989, had 36 or so scientists per year dive under the ice, an average 900 to 1,000 dives per year. Fairly incident-free. It's a very safe and effective method to work. However, what's usually forgotten is the amount of training, medical supervision, equipment considerations, logistics, and so on, to be able to go spend 30 to 40 minutes in minus 1.86 degrees centigrade water. And compared to many of our colleagues here at the Smithsonian, tropical biodiversity and rainforests, it's easy enough to climb up a tree and collect the bugs from the canopy and climb back down. So it's a very labor-intensive, it's not without a certain degree of risk. We've been able to manage that risk fairly well. We have several things going for us. One, nobody's going to go drown themselves on purpose. Works in our favor from a risk management perspective. And the other thing is that the technology has really advanced from the days where it was wet diving. And how many of you are divers? Are there scuba divers here? How many of you are polar divers? Good, so I can tell a few lies and you won't know the difference, right? So we no longer dive in wetsuits with wet gloves, double hose regulators like the old Mike Nelson Sea Hunt days. We now have electronic dive computers that monitor our decompression time and on-gassing of inert gas. We have dry suits with dry glove systems. We have ThinSolate, and now in collaboration with the U.S. Navy are working on aerogel products to further reduce the amount of weight we need and increase the passive insulation capacities that we use to maintain our body temperature and prevent thermal injuries. So again, it's a pleasure being here, and I hope I can contribute something in that respect, but want to keep in mind that while we have infrastructure and equipment and technology and tools, there's no real replacement yet for the trained scientific eye underwater in the environment. Thank you.
Thank you. If there isn't any other comment, no more from panelists?
Well, I just wanted to make one if I may. Just going back, I think, to the point that, and I noticed that Olaf and I made the same note. The whole question of marine protected areas. The process within Camelot that I referred to is actually only the beginning of the first step, point well taken about both the 2002 Johannesburg summit and indeed the requirements of the Biodiversity Convention. Camelot, the 11 areas that I indicated on that map, were defined by a very rigorous scientific process to draw out the elements that characterize them as being different from each other. And they have been identified as candidate sites by both the CEP and Camelot as the candidate sites in which there would be developed a network of marine protected areas, or if you would like, specially managed areas. Marine protected areas seems to be an anathematic term to a lot of people. So I'd rather talk to them as protected, as managed, specially managed areas in the context, not of the treaty, but in the context of the activity. And that means they can be closed, they can be put aside with nothing at all, they can have differential fishing in them, they can have only scientific research in them, or whatever. And that is all predefined. But I do think that there has been a meeting of minds in that particular case between Camelot and the CEP, the Scientific Committee of Camelot and the CEP, as this is a hugely high-level priority which both committees need to pool their expertise in to pursue. And I think that's a very important thing to recognize.
Okay, then before I give a floor to the audience, I'd like to ask you that we might focus our discussion on how to enhance the role of science in an Antarctic treaty regime. I'd like to a little bit focus on that. That's the one I'd like to ask you. Danny, okay?
David Walton. Listening to Olaf's account with input from Tony Press and Neil Gilbert of the development of the CEP, as the SCAR representative previously on the CEP, I recognise many of the features, although I would not perhaps have given the same emphasis as Olaf did. One of the things that I think holds the CEP back was the original rules of procedure, and that was to determine that no meeting would be held without simultaneous translation into all four languages, which means that holding any meetings other than the annual ones is extraordinarily expensive. Now, Denzel is sitting next to you. He has been running an organisation which doesn't have that rule. It's part of the treaty system, and yet their committees meet very effectively to discuss the science matters, and they meet in English and report to the scientific committee. One, surely, of the best ways forward for the CEP to facilitate its work and to engage more of the community would actually to change that rule so that it would be possible to have intersessional meetings of experts that would feed into the work of the CEP. And a further element that would help would be if the CEP had some ability to manage its activities intersessionally, either through the Secretariat or, as was once suggested by Chile, through a separate CEP secretariat that ran data facilities and so on? Would that not actually help in managing the business of taking the science and turning it into policy?
You had several points there, and I would agree with many of them. In fact, on my overhead, I said maybe intersessional formal decision-making process will be needed. There is, of course, nothing to stop having intersessional work today if the ATCM so decides. I mean, next week there's intersessional meeting of experts in Wellington, only in one language. In April next year, there's intersessional meeting of experts on climate. CP is involved in both of these heavily, and the ATCM could set up any meeting intersessionally of CP if they're so asked for. So there's no formal requirement for that. The meeting, annual meeting of the CP, which is in four languages, certainly would be cheaper if we could do it in one language. I'm not sure if we would get wider participation. I don't think that's the fundamental problem. But we tried very hard in my period to get agreement among the treaty parties that we could do certain types of work with only one language. In fact, there are, as you know, four languages. Two of the three language groups that are not English said, yes, they would go along with that. The third group said, no. And we worked very much on the model of the scientific committee of Camelot, and Denzel will know this because I asked his advice on how they managed to do this. We did not manage to do that in the ATCM. And the argument from those who are other language groups would actually be that they were not able to participate so well. So, and that's a serious argument, because it is a reality that within an English-speaking only community, those that are either from the English-speaking languages or those like myself who've been lucky enough to be exposed long enough to English to at least understand the basic English, if not everything else, those have an advantage. And it's, if this is ever going to come through, it will never come through as a proposition from an Englishman or from a US person, because they are looked on with good reason as not being balanced in this. It has to come through from people like myself or from a Korean or somebody else who feels this would be useful. But as I say, we have tried very hard, because it clearly is an impediment to the work. What happens now is that informal consultations go on, and you have open-ended contact groups all working in English. So the English is, of course, used for obvious good reasons. I think those are the main points that you make, but I hope that intersessional work will be even more prevalent, and eventually we will have meetings. But it's not obvious, it's not easy. That's, the cost is only part of it.
Give a microphone to Michael.
Thank you. I thought David was about to ask the question that I wanted to pose, but the issue I wanted to raise is whether there's a virtue or otherwise in keeping the scientific advisory role separate from what I'd call the executive role of the body politic. I think it's a question probably for Olaf, but Denzel might wish to comment as well. Now, Olaf made the comment that the CEP should be a working place of competence. And the inference I took from that, that at least at certain times, it is less than perfectly competent. Now, there is a direct parallel, at least institutionally, between the Scientific Committee of Camelot and its commission, and then the role of the CEP in respect of the ATCM. Mm. Yet, the Scientific Committee of Camelot is just that, and almost woe betide anybody who is non-scientific to enter its portal. The problem, I suppose, stems from the rules of procedure of the CEP, which were, as Olaf said, adopted at Tromsø. And what we failed to write into those rules of procedure, which you will clearly see written into the rules of procedure of the Scientific Committee of Camelot, is that there should be an appropriate competence in terms of the CEP, presumably a competence in environmental and technical matters, before, in fact, one should be a member of that committee. Now, I just pose the question that the CEP has now been in operation for more than 10 years. We've gone through three chairs, or there's still one current chair, and I might be as bold as to suggest as to whether the wisdom of those three chairs could not suggest that those rules be revisited and, in fact, altered? Thank you.
Well, maybe I can answer first, but I mean, for sure, Denzel can say how much better it works in Camelot. And what we achieved in 1998 was, I believe, the best achievable. And there was a hesitancy, I suspect, but I could be wrong, for the ATCM to let this newborn baby divide itself too far from the body politic, as to what you use the standards of the ATCM. There may be other reasons. Maybe we didn't fight it hard enough. I don't want to guess on that. The reality is that there is, of course, an indication of the kind of competence that should be in the CEP, in the rules of procedure, or in the actual text of the protocol, but there's no enforcement and nobody checks whether that competence is there or not. So I think but I don't think that's the fundamental issue. I think it would be easier to work if we did solve the language thing and we made this a very clear group of experts, because in all countries, of course, there are English-speaking experts on these issues if they wanted to go that way. But it's CP is partly a mixture of politics and partly an advisory body. That's the reality.
Well, thank you. I actually have got a question here that someone passed to me, which is, I think, directly related to some of the discussion we've just been having, and particularly the points Mark raised. And that says, under the consensus rule, is there any way to prevent members from stopping the best scientific advice from Camelot Scientific Committee due to economic or political reasons? And could you reflect briefly on this? I think, if I may say so, I'm probably in the unique position of having gone through the Camelot Scientific Committee during its formative years, and I've also had lucky enough to have been involved with the CEP during its formative years as well. And there are some parallels there. The scientific committee of Camelot for the first probably about 7 or 8 years really grappled with its agenda. What should it be doing? What procedural issues and how it should deal with procedure and process in providing advice to the commission? And it really actually took some dialogue between the commission and the scientific committee along the lines of, this is the advice, is it any good to you? And the commission saying, well, we can't make a decision on this advice. And then someone at some level higher up in the commission actually putting in some anecdotal material. So the first thing that came was this recognition that the scientific committee of Camelot, and this was about 1990, so the scientific committee had been in being for about 8 years, was the notion that the scientific committee is the place where the scientific advice or data is reviewed, and then it provides advice. Now, that advice does not necessarily need to be consensus advice. I think all of us demonstrated the same kind of thing in the CP. But what the scientific committee actually learned was that if it provided advice that was not consensus advice, it then had to provide, first and foremost, a balanced reflection of what the different issues involved and why this was not consensus advice. And secondly, if possible, to balance that with some analysis of the uncertainties in the advice and what the consequences of certain actions would be if one type of advice was applied and another wasn't, or vice versa. And I think that was a really seminal process. And by about 1990, by the time the first precautionary catch limit came in for krill in 1991, that was where we had got. And that process was exactly duplicated and mirrored, in my view, in a lot of the early discussions in the CEP. Now, that, for Camelot, liberated the scientific committee and it formed this dialogue. And since that time, up until relatively recently, that has been a really constructive engagement where the scientific committee's advice is respected by the commission. There is very little political interference in the development of that advice. There's always politics involved at some level. But that then, nevertheless, if there is, it's clear that there is. The differences of opinion are clear, and that is then the decision is taken by the commission. Now, that has changed. In the last couple of years, that's changed a little bit. Now, that may be changed because there have been changes in personnel, changes in process. I don't think there's a change in process. I think the intention of the process is still there. But that's something that probably Kamala will need to deal with, as to get back that dialogue. That dialogue is not as clear and as pure as it used to be, in my view, and it's my view only, and my personal view only, that needs to be clarified a little bit more. I think the CEP hasn't quite got to that, almost, it's a derogatory term, almost to that level of maturity as yet, that need to be able to put some element of optionality in the advice, but to say that the scenarios that would follow are here and there. And that goes, again, to the engagement and the competency of those involved. That's a personal view. Hopefully it helps some of you to see the parallels and the differences in the two situations.
Okay, Heinz first.
Thank you. Well, a question to Olaf. Wouldn't you think that part of the problem that we're facing in CEP is that there are different national enactments of the Madrid Protocol, and that prevents a free discussion?
No, I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure about the different national enactments. I think in some cases, this becomes theoretical, so I'm going to illustrate it since we have now an intervention from a marine geophysicist from Germany. I will illustrate this, I think, if you will allow me, with a concrete example, and then you will understand better what I'm talking about. A hot issue in the CEP has been whether acoustic surveys have environmental impacts or not. Okay? Now, that is one where the scientists, say SCAR, has given advice, but other members of the CEP come with their own national instructions almost, because within their own countries they have a particular approach to the issue of acoustic surveys, which is different from SCAR's. In some cases, SCAR's been fairly benign, if I can use that word on this, saying it has little impact. But the German group, and that's why I use that, and I can say this because it's obviously public knowledge among those who work there, in the German delegation, German Ministry of the Environment says acoustic surveys are harmful to the environment, whereas the CEP person from Avi, who's not the leader of that delegation, but is there as a scientific advisor, says it's not harmful. And when you have that kind of differences of opinion, even within a country, and then you have groups within the CEP meaning one thing or another, it's not exactly easy to sort this out to become a pure scientific advice. And I agree that we have a way, or the CEP still has a way to go there. And if it goes away, it goes down some line, it must be able to, I suspect it must be able to do what Denzel did. We must be able to show them what we believe are the consequences of this or that action. And perhaps one of the useful things coming out of this meeting would be the kind of question that Mike Richardson posed. Maybe we are getting that maturity when we can challenge the ATCM to say, allow the CEP to become even more independent in giving its scientific advice. But it's not as if there's no prevention of advice. It's exactly the same as in the Camilla. The CEP can say exactly what it likes. It's not imposed as such. But when you have, as I say, within a delegation certain opinions decided by a ministry, it is not as if they themselves are exactly free to handle that problem.
Okay. Valerie is first.
I have two questions. First question to Denzel. Kamlar in this year organized a first marine protection area in Antarctica. Total number of same areas of Kamlar is 11. What do you think about national control in this marine protection area? For example, if only two or three countries will have control in this 11 marine protection area in Antarctica. What do you think about this situation? And second question to Chuck, what is perspective of geological research in Antarctica? After very strong limit of Madrid Protocol to any geological research in this area, what do you think about perspective of this scientific research? Thank you.
Okay, I think, Valerie, thanks for the question. I think in the first instance, the just want to perhaps make it clear that the 11 areas that have been identified by CAMELA are candidate areas. They're not protected areas as yet. They have not been afforded that status. There has been the shelf area of the South Orkneys, which is an area of about 56,000 square kilometres, has been designated as an area where science can be undertaken but no fishing can be undertaken. So if you would like to call that a protected area, a marine protected area, then, you know, be my guest. But, and that was done on an objective basis using the information, the kind of information that had been provided in, to identify the candidate areas. But those candidate areas are not in the control of anybody at the moment, and they're not actually designated as such. There's only one area, and that is the area that I referred to on the South Orkney Shelf. Hopefully that answers your question.
Chuck?
I think Valerie's referring to the question of whether geological research could be considered resource exploration. Essentially, SCAR has no position on that, I'd say, that particular thing. But we have a very robust geosciences program within SCAR that includes scientific drilling, and we're certainly supportive of scientific drilling. So I'm not sure I can comment on whether that can be considered exploration for resources. But, again, I think there's international consensus through all the programs that I showed, Andrill, shell drill, including the Integrated Ocean Drilling Program that drills, has programs in the past around the margins of Antarctica, are considered scientific drilling, and SCAR supports scientific investigations.
Olaf, you have a
question? Just make one more additional comment. The difference between, might say, exploration for minerals and geologic science is not necessarily large sometimes in the activity, just as it could be in marine bioprospecting and the science of investigating biodiversity. However, there's a huge difference in one way, and that is the deciding line, not the activity, is whether the stuff is published or not. In one case, it's published. All science is published. And there's nothing stopping publishable science, whatever kind of activity you're doing in Antarctica. If the knowledge gained is proprietary and kept within the group, then it's an industrial activity, and that is not allowed in the Antarctic on land.
Okay.
I'd like to pursue a little bit further this question about the entanglement of the political and the scientific aspects in the CEP, and more precisely the concept that you referred to, minor or transitory. With four languages, I suppose it also translates into four different in different ways. But how did you manage to sort of triangulate a kind of a bar where you would have a deciding line? Did you have a checklist, or I'm just curious about, you know, how you tackled this and got some form of stability? Because I mean, the terms in themselves have an interpretive flexibility in whatever context you're in.
One of the fascinating aspects of the environmental protocol, for those who get into this, will be to discover this is written in part by lawyers, in part by diplomats, and to a very small extent by scientists. I think that's a fair description. And considerable parts of it was lifted from the agreed measures in 1964, modified. Part of it was lifted from the CRAMRA and modified, all put into one package. I'm simplifying and I'm talking black and white, but that's a major part of the story. Now, it's the protocol that uses these terms in its definition on when to apply environmental evaluations. And none of those who wrote those words spent any time in the kind of fine division line of what it meant.
I'm not saying they didn't think around it. That would be totally unfair. But they didn't necessarily think of it in the words that would be used by a manager. So over the subsequent years, we've had a lot of environmental evaluations presented. And sometimes there's been debates on whether a particular evaluation should have been moved from initial to comprehensive, for example. But it's a body of practice that's developed and not the body of definition. And we've tried and we've spent, I can't remember how many years, on trying to redefine the text of some of the annexes, or rather one annex, which finally was passed at the EATCM here in Baltimore. And in the protocol it says you can change the annexes. I'm talking now in layman's terms, but there's a provision for changing the annexes which is much simpler than changing the protocol itself. The protocol, it's unthinkable that it would be changed. And this is the annex dealing with comprehensive environmental evaluations. That was not the one we changed. But if we want to go into changing that, last time it took, I think, 8 years. You can imagine how long it is. And the reason it takes so long is that the original workers of these words often were balancing something else, not science, not practicality, but a couple of different legal positions which they were coming at this issue. And so the language is not, you cannot relate the language to science or to management. You have to relate it to the original diplomatic negotiations. And that means it's very, very hard even to change the annexes. So there is no good answer to your question. Because there's a logic, but the logic is not obviously pervasive.
Okay. Yeah, your turn. No. It's the person.
She's been waiting a long time. Marie has been waiting with the microphone for a very long time.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I wanted to take the floor because so as to continue the discussion that Mike Richardson started on the qualification of the members of the CEP, because during the negotiations to the protocol, the environmental protocol, this was a big issue. Who would be appointed to the CEP? And of course, the protocol itself says that it is the parties to the protocol that appoint someone to be a member, and that member might be accompanied by experts and advisors. So it was very clear that if there is only going to be a change in that, it will be done not by the rules and procedures of the CEP, but by the consultative parties themselves. And this brings me to my question, which is really, because when you hear the discussion here, it's like the scientific committee of CAMELAR and CEP are equivalent bodies. But to my mind and knowledge, they are not. The scientific committee of CAMELAR is a scientific body, whereas the task for the CEP is much wider. For any of you who are interested, you just read the mandate in the basic documents. So the question is, rather, what would the two bodies, what they could learn from each other? Because whereas the CEP is advising on a wider level, the commission, the CAMELAR commission, is directly linked to scientific advice. And I very much like to hear some comments about that. Thank you.
Somebody make a very concise answer, can you?
Yeah, well, absolutely. That's about as concise as I can be. I think the remit is different. But I do think that the practicalities of providing the advice remain the same. And that is that, and I go back to originally, that is that it's preventing, if you like, in the collective, in the application of the mind, the collective consequence of actions that would be connected to different kinds of advice. Now, you need to have an expertise to do that. Whether in the case of CAMELAR, it's science, as far in all respects. And the CEP, it may be broader than that. But I think that that's the only way you'll solve the problem.
Well, time is running out, but I like to make just one more you know, question. He has a long waiting, so he will be the last one. Only time is running out.
Yeah. Just briefly, in developing the system of representative protected areas, whatever word we put on them, I think many of us would agree that joint CEP Camelot Scientific Committee meeting was crucial to laying a good foundation for moving forward. And my question is, do you think we need more such meetings if we're going to deliver on a goal of having a really representative system set up by 2012, which I think is the agreed target date now?
Well, I mean, again, I don't know, I'm just leaping in here because I know we're short of time, but why that meeting was so successful was it was very focused and it came at the right time. I would hate to think that there should be a customary, that meetings should become the end to bring these two groups together. What is required is obvious, and I think it was a very good outcome, was that there should be very clear channels of communication. And I think it was the very first time that there had been a discussion between members of the committee, of both committees, with each other, rather than through some formalized process. They were in the same forum and they were talking together. And that is what needs to be nurtured. And I still think there's some thought to be done in the procedural way as how that... Now, that might be meetings, but it also might not be how that can be done on issues that have overlap or have joint priority. And I'm optimistic that will come. You're right, that was a breakthrough meeting. And I think it set some good habits. And that is where the learning process is coming from. Scientific Committee of Camelot has things to learn from the CEP. I'm absolutely convinced of that. So it's a two-way dialogue, and we've got to get that right.
Thank you for your participation. I'd like to ask you two more questions, but please use it during the coffee time, okay? I'd like to all of you for your participation and patience. I give this medal to two newcomer. It's Peter, it's for you. So medal for participation is for Michael.
Thank you.
Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Kim Sam, I'd also like to thank you for your stewardship of the session and present you.
Okay, thank you very much.